This week, an interesting look on the story from Genesis, Am I My Brother's Keeper? Cain and Abel, what can we learn about the psychology in this mythic allegory? Then, Worshipful Brother Patrick Day is back with another awesome segment of Masonic Mythbusters. This week, Brother Patrick Day takes us through the history of the guild systems. Did Freemasonry truly come from the guilds? Did guilds come from the collegium? Was Freemasonry influenced by either? This week, Brother Patrick Day lays it all out there as usual in his awesome style. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 568. I'd like to thank the fellows, producers, contributors, legacy partners of the WCY podcast. If you'd like to know more about how to assist this program, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. In the news, we are late with this show once more. I do have to really apologize. We've just been having a very busy October with Grand Lodge sessions and trips here and there, but we've got a great show this week. Before we get into the education, I just will remind everybody the presentation schedule that is up. We've got one change on there, but as of right now, we are going to be doing on Friday the 28th of October, Freemasonry, A History of Mystery, at the Fall Festive Board at Edmund Lodge number 37. You can find a link to where to get tickets for that. That's going to be at the Will Rogers Room at the University of Oklahoma. Then the next day, at the Valley of Guthrie, Oklahoma, I'll be doing the Tetragrammaton from the Quantum Series Lectures, Lecture number 2. And I'll be doing that during the fall reunion at 3 p.m. Now, there's going to be a full day of degrees and things, and I'll be there for all of that. And just giving a quick lecture, about 45 minutes or so in the midst of the day at about 3 p.m. And that'll be again at the Valley of Guthrie on the 29th. And then that night, I'll be doing Quantum Entanglement and Apotheosis for Veritas Lodge 556 at their festive board, which is located at the historic Dominion House in Guthrie. So just a few minutes away from the Scottish Rite Temple. The fellowship will begin at 5 p.m., dinner at 6, and the cost for that event is $125 for an evening of camaraderie, good food, and Masonic Brotherhood in a Masonically historic venue. The event there is open to all Master Masons, and you can contact Brother Jason Marshall by October 7th to RSVP, which it is well past. So I hope you have already done that. And then I'll be off in the Valley of Spartanburg, Orient of South Carolina, and I'll be doing the Masonic Pub Crawl, Freemasonry in America and its Colonial Tavern Beginnings. And if you would like to get reservations, the cost for the event, I believe, is $10, and you'll want to contact Brother Freddie Thompson, 33rd degree, at AASR, like Ancient Accepted Scottish Rite, at charter.net. So that's it for the presentation schedule. I did have one cancellation. I will not be doing the Ark and Freemasonry for Lakeside Lodge 258 in Washington. They've got some pressing business to take care of, so we're going to reschedule that and put a pin in it for next time. But that's it for that. Let's go ahead and get into the education this week. This week, I wanted to read a piece called Am I My Brother's Keeper? It is by Pamela McDowne, 30th degree. She is a member of Universal Co-Masonry. Regardless of your views on regular masonry, the philosophy is the same. It is all relevant to the royal art. Am I My Brother's Keeper? By Pamela McDowne, 30th degree. It was published on January 31st, back in 2019, so just before the start of the pandemic. What can the ancient story of Cain and Abel teach us about the human journey and our relationship with God? In Freemasonry, the term brother is used to demonstrate a closeness of relationship that is not necessarily based on blood ties. It is formed from a common bond, shared obligations, and experiences. In addition, being a child of the Divine Father or Great Architect accounts for a sacred, cemented kinship with each other. Lately, the question, am I my brother's keeper, has been echoing in my mind in terms of my own Masonic obligations. This question goes to the foundation of what it means to be of service in the great work. The ultimate aim in Masonic teachings is the mastery of self through reflection, actions, and acceptance of the sublime lessons of immortality. The student is encouraged to temper their emotions and control their vices and practice the tenets of brotherly love, relief, and truth. This line of thinking led me to revisit the story of Cain and Abel, and the actual source of the Brother's Keeper phrase. As in any holy book, like the Bible, there is a fair debate whether passages should be treated as literally or merely malleable allegory. The seeming contradictions are common for writings that span over centuries. Each individual's faith, academic viewpoint, view of religion, or personal worldview certainly comes into play in interpreting the text. I was hoping to find some Masonic insight in this age-old Bible story. Basically, the passages from Genesis 4:1 through 16 can be summarized like this. Cain was the first son of Adam and Eve, and Abel was the second son. Cain was a farmer, and Abel was a shepherd. When it came time to bring an offering to the Lord, Cain offered fruit, and Abel offered a slain lamb. The Lord was satisfied with Abel's offering, but unsatisfied in Cain's. Cain, filled with jealousy, killed his brother. After the murder, we read in Genesis 4:9, the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel your brother?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Things did not go well for Cain. Translated from the original Hebrew, the word keeper refers to someone who watches over or guards. What is the symbolic meaning of these two characters? Could they relate to the quest of a Freemason, Cain and Abel, from darkness to light? Some theories say that Cain and Abel were twins, and each twin could represent our higher and lower natures. This speaks to the heart of the Masonic work, which is learning to navigate the duality of our existence. For example, there would be no light without darkness, no good without evil, no love without hate, and so on. Comparing light versus darkness is an important study. However, what's curious about the subject of light is that everyone knows what it is until you ask them. In the Bible, we read that God is light. This quotation evokes a mystery. It suggests that there is a deeper connection to the subject of light than meets the eye. It seems unlikely that when you go into a room and flip a switch, you are turning on God. Equally mysterious is the concept of darkness. Recently, in a lodge meeting, we studied Brother Leonard Bosman's work, The Light of a Master Mason. Bosman proposes that the myth of Cain and Abel is about the Freemasons' battle between two opposite aspects of the mind. The grand struggle deals with the incompatibility of these two natures, especially when the ego is in control. From Light of a Master Mason, we read, quote, "Abel is the love mind, Cain the head or brain mind. Abel is the heart or spirit, Cain the earthly mentality. Hence, it is that, symbolically as well as in actually, Cain kills his brother Abel. That is to say, that the hard Cain-like mind kills the pure love nature, Abel, when preventing its functioning." End quote. Bosman makes a good point that Abel is not the one struggling. The struggle is about Cain because the ego is always in a constant struggle to kill off the higher nature. The ego wants total control because to sacrifice the ego is to die to self and let the light nature live through you. No easy task. Both aspects of the mind have a function. Cain, according to the inner meaning of its etymology, represents the hard-pointed weapon of the mind. Cain is the selfish, acquisitive mind, the getter, the centralizer, whilst Abel is the yielding one, the giver. If this is all true, then how do we master these two aspects of our nature? The symbolic key may lie in Tubal Cain, a blacksmith character in the Bible who was the son of Lamech, a descendant of Cain. He was known as an artificer in metals, of brass and iron. In the legend, there is a biological connection as well as a symbolic one. Bosman writes that Freemasonry may be, quote, "thought of as an alchemical experiment, the lodge in this sense being the great alchemist's cauldron in which the base metal of the lower nature will be changed into the gold of the spiritual." Further on, in Light of a Master Mason, we read, quote, "In all this, the student of Freemasonry will see the inner and secret meaning of Tubal Cain, the yielding of the central might, or egotistic mind, the letting go, as it were, of the personal self, as it spreads out to become a greater self, the one that is in all." End quote. In other words, the more we cling to self-importance and ego, the more we are undoubtedly living in darkness. The mystical worker will often cry, "When I'm nothing, I'm everything." This might possibly be why so few people truly seek an authentic path to enlightenment. Who wants to be nothing? We've all been told the whole purpose is to be somebody. We could draw two conclusions from all of this. We could decide that the Cain and Abel legend is simply a good story, an illusory tale to tell our children, or we can assume that it does have some merit in its symbolic import. I prefer the second option myself, if only because it jives with my own intuition as a Masonic worker that we can learn about ourselves from symbols. Am I my brother's keeper? Indeed, I try to make daily progress in Masonic light. Sounds simple, but it's probably the hardest concept a Freemason has to learn. That's okay, because it also offers a lifetime of value. It ends with a quote. "What the sad world needs, what each of us needs, is more light, more love, more clarity of mind, and more charity of heart. And this, in copious measure, is what Freemasonry gives us, if only we let the light of love enter the dark recesses of our hearts." Brother Yathindra Kumar. What a great article in thinking about how this particular story could be seen as an allegory for psychological work. What is interesting is she dives a little bit into the meaning of the words and context. And when she dives into this, I think it serves the article. Of course, I think this story really comes to the best kind of historical contextual look, I guess you could call it, in a book that I've talked about many times, which is Robert Alter's translation with commentary on the Pentateuch. In it, we learn the nature of the names of Cain and Abel, which leads us to find out that Abel is always one who will die. And in this, does that change this idea of Cain and Abel and murder of a certain psychological aspect or perhaps a warning to how best serve our egos? I'd love to know if all the Craftsman Plus out there, it's been a couple weeks since we've had a question on there. I would love to hear if you have other stories from a volume of sacred law that speaks to perhaps an allegory relating to the subconscious and conscious mind. For instance, I believe the Bhagavad Gita is almost entirely an internal struggle story. I'm not alone in that interpretation at all. However, are there other stories within the Bible or within the Quran or the Tanakh or other holy books that you've read that have a allegory as a living tale and yet could be relating to inner psychology? I'd love to hear your answers. You can post those in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group. Next up, I think you know what time it is. Get excited.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out of context quotes on memes and sound bites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
What were the guilds? We as Masons are usually told that modern-day Freemasonry evolved out of the stonemason guilds of the Middle Ages, and we usually accept this. And it has been historically attested, especially based on old lodge records that register a member as a, quote, Mark Mason and Mark Master. These were old designations for operative stonemasons in which they have registered a mark or an emblem that acts as their signature for their work. Mason marks are old. We actually have precedents for them going back to classical Greece and Rome. When a journeyman, or as the stonemasons called them, the fellows of the craft, when they would register a mark, it was usually a variation of their master's mark or was just assigned to them by their guild. Masters usually had the freedom to invent their own mark, and these would be registered with the guild to hold the quality of production accountable to the producer. The registration of the mark probably was accompanied by some brief ceremony of which the Mark Master degree is a remnant of. though it is now much more elaborate than anything the operative stonemason guilds would have conducted. Regardless, we know operative stonemasons joined speculative lodges, as is indicative of old registers. And as we will see, speculative masons would be part of operative lodges, and this is likely how speculative lodges began, namely by splitting off from the old operative lodges. So, what were the guilds? If you're like me, you likely have come across some Masonic writing or presentations that present the guilds as something like, oh, I don't know, a mystery school, whatever that means. Or simply as a place for like-minded individuals to come together and freely discuss ideas, or some ritualistic secret society sharing mysteries of the universe or work to higher aims through common ideals, etc., etc. Things like video games and whatnot do not help this image of the guilds, such as things like the so-called, you might come across in a video game, something like the Thieves Guild, or in Terry Pratchett's novels, right, the Assassin's Guild. I love you, Terry Pratchett, and I'm so sorry you died angry in your dementia, and I pray your soul is more at peace than you were at the end of your life. But an Assassin's Guild is an absolutely absurd concept. But maybe you were going for that, which seems totally appropriate in the Discworld novels, but aside. All too often, Masonic discussions on what the guilds were just sounds like a poor rehashing of them as early Freemasonry, though such cannot be further from the truth. Now, I am often accused of superimposing contemporary ideals on the past, that I take my high-minded ideals, if I have any ideals, and I impose them on the past. I think that's more of a political accusation, because I judge the past with my own prejudices, as I would anything today, and I don't hide that. If I think something is wrong today, I think it was wrong then. That's my biases, and I offer it freely. However, when it comes to examining the past, really trying to understand and explore history, I confine contextualization and comprehension of the past to what was going on back then. This is loosely known as material or dialectical historiography, as was first proposed by Friedrich Engels. If we want to understand the guilds, we need to drop any biases we have for Freemasonry and understand them in their own time, their own context, as they were in their time. So forget Freemasonry for a while and let's explore the guilds, how they came to be, their possible predecessors, and ultimately their demise and how they may have become modern-day Masonic lodges. The most thorough survey of sincere academic integrity on the guilds under the sun is, beyond a doubt, Stephen Epstein's Wage Labor and Guilds in Medieval Europe. Dr. Epstein is a professor emeritus of the Department of History at the University of Kansas, with a specialty in medieval European economics and social history. This text might be the only truly intensive and in-depth analysis of the nature and function of the guilds and medieval society that is available in English. That said, it is very dry and rigidly academic, so fair warning if you want to read this book, though I highly recommend it, but it is dry. Thus, it will be the work I will largely be depending on and relying on here, so the following I'm getting into is more of a book report than an actual research project of mine. Just full disclosure. You may have heard in Masonic education or a Masonic paper that an early precursor to the guilds was the Collegia of ancient Rome. There are a few examples of associations of laborers under common traits in Hellenistic Greece, but there is nothing as substantial as the Roman Collegia. The term, collegium, etymologically indicates that they were a group of people bound together by common rules and laws. The term collegia was used very loosely, at least at first. Practically any group of three or more people with a common goal could call themselves college. And the title of college was not exactly regulated, at least not at first. There were some colleges that were more of what we might call a sororitas, or a social club, and typically functioned more like a secret society than a college. Kind of. This is where we're trying to apply our more common conceptions of these things today than really totally reflect what was going on back then. Nonetheless, it's kind of an approximation of what they were. There were also organizations that were called colleges, but were more like funerary associations. And funerary associations are something that predates Rome. Essentially, one would pay an association an annual stipend. And when they died, the association ensured that that person received all the proper rites of burial that their membership in the association entitled them to. It's kind of a way of having like life insurance back then, I guess. And certainly Masons kind of do this today, so it's a similar concept that still persists today, and certainly goes way back before the Roman Collegia. Now, we do not know the early history of the Collegia. Later authors created fantastical myths and legends of their origins, but from a historical point of view, their genesis belongs to time immemorial. Plutarch tells us that King Numa, who is the second king of Rome, established 8 artisan groups as colleges. There were the musicians, goldsmiths, carpenters, dyers, shoemakers, tanners, braziers, and potters. But no masons. Ooh. Colleges kind of started to become heavily political organizations, some of which were engaged in political conspiracy. They endorsed candidates for office. Emperors attempted to supplant political factions in the colleges, but it was really not until Emperor Marcus Aurelius, as well as Emperor Lucius Verus, that the colleges began to be pulled under the reign of the emperors. They both sought to utilize the colleges as a means to serve the state, especially, you know, certain programs like principles like Panem et Circenses, right? Bread and circuses. So the baker's guilds would be producing bread for the bread and circuses. Now, laws were passed that one could not join more than one college. So this is starting to get into regulating the colleges. And that colleges were granted certain rights over specific trades and commerce, starting to become kind of like monopolies. Tradesmen were incentivized to join colleges, though it was not entirely necessary. All colleges had divine patrons, such as Minerva, Jupiter, etc. In the same way, Masonic lodges are said to be patronized by Saints John the Baptist and the Evangelist. Sometimes noble citizens, otherwise not engaged in active trades, could join the colleges. The purpose for this, as was commonly practiced in the medieval guilds, was for the patron to lend his influences and legal counsels on behalf of the college. But it was also to force the colleges to be responsible for their behavior. Colleges also practiced religious observances and banquets. So a lot of this sounds kind of familiar, and it's thus not uncommon. Now, for all that the colleges look like an ancient form of the guilds, they had as many differences as they had similarities. There was no system of apprenticeship, or at least there are none stipulated in old Roman laws. When we look at the conditions of the colleges before the fall of the Roman Empire, they were more or less under a tyrannical control of the emperor. It eventually became mandated that one could not leave their college, and sons of college members had to then go work for the same college. They were kind of more or less enslaved to the colleges, and were forced to work for the state. Though they still got paid, so kind of not slavery. Now, the colleges ultimately came to an end, at least in the Roman West, due to depopulation, owing to barbarian attacks, and well, really the collapse of the Roman economy. The colleges function on economy, so when the economy collapsed, so did the colleges. We might say that the colleges in the Roman West ended in the collapse of the empire in 476 CE. Now, in the Roman East, which split away from the West in 330 CE, the colleges functioned in some capacities, but mostly as a tax system for artisans to sustain the state's income. They barely resemble the colleges as we've previously explored them. So in the Roman East and Constantinople, they don't really look like anything we've looked at in Rome proper. Now, even the invading barbarians picked up on the usefulness of Rome's tax system for the colleges, even if they did not maintain colleges in any meaningful manner. They definitely picked up on the tax system for it, and it was kind of useful. The surviving remnants of the colleges by the end of the empire were more or less beset by violence, and all practically turned to political subversion and criminal activity. Now, lastly concerning the colleges is that there was an attempt to revive them in the 8th or 9th century. They wanted to revive them based on the old Roman laws, basically picking up where things left off, but this, of course, was a total disaster, as one would expect. The colleges were under tyrannical rule of the emperor, so trying to reform the colleges under tyrannical rule, well, things fell apart pretty quickly. The earliest emergence of the guilds are in the Carolingian era, about 400 years after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. But these were more associations of common citizens and not quite yet a guild. Guilds were almost entirely unnecessary until the 11th century. The guilds almost spring up spontaneously all across Europe, and really completely irrelevant of the Roman Collegia. The earliest laws for these guilds did not outline them as artisan associations, but rather groups of laymen who lived in the same parish. Basically, it was kind of a non-religious confraternity with nothing more in common than where they lived and the church where they paid their tithes. It was not possible for guilds to really function as we think of them because the Carolingian era did not have a sophisticated economy yet like the Romans had. They mostly still relied on barter and trade. The entire function of the guild can be found in its name, guild, gilda or guilt, which indicates the necessity of coin and monetary exchange in connection with associations dedicated to a specific trade. So until a sophisticated economy was developed, there was no tradesmen guilds. Masons oftentimes will look to King Athelstan of England, whose reign lasted from 927 to 939 CE, though he was previously king of the Anglo-Saxons from 925 to 927. Now, Athelstan is seen by Masons as the founder of stonemason guilds, as is mentioned in various old constitutions, such as the Regius Manuscript, and this is played on in, say, the York Rite College. However, there is no historical proof King Athelstan chartered a group of stonemasons to form a guild. What Athelstan is historically known for, as it concerns the guilds, is that he drew a system of rules for what has become known as peace guilds. This was a mean to bring lawfulness to his kingdom and had almost nothing to do with craft trade associations. The only sophisticated economy in the West at the time was Byzantium, Constantinople, where there were a variety of craft guilds, but these were springing up in the 9th and 10th centuries. In the Islamic world, they were not keen on carrying on the legacy of the Roman colleges, so their system of guilds was strictly their own. And even these were drastically different from their later European counterparts, and really just become their own total area of study. What evolves in these centuries in Europe that permitted the rise of the guilds is what we would call wage labor, which is effectively a refined economic form of coercion. Basically, societies need labor, but to force people to work, they had to be paid in some meaningful manner. Now, this was not necessary under the barter and trade system, and especially if the economy is not big and sophisticated enough, barter and trade kind of prevents wage labor from even being necessary. Nobody wants to do it. Nobody wants to be forced to work, even for monetary exchange. But when societies get big enough, such as it was happening in medieval Europe, and barter and trade starts to become a hindrance, thus evolves wage labor. Thus is born the guilds, which really first appeared in the 11th and 12th centuries in Europe. Now, when we speak of a guild, there are several requisites that are needed to define them. At least historically, as we look at them, we can create some definitions. Firstly, they are professional trade associations. Second, they must be government sanctioned, usually by decree or charter of the king, lord, or governor. Lastly, they are a monopoly. This last item is key to understanding the guilds. They hold a monopoly on a specific trade, and they are the only ones permitted to practice that trade in a commercial capacity. Obviously, one can still bake bread at home, but to bake and sell bread is under the dominion of the baker's guilds. The emergence of the guild system implies a sophisticated economy has developed to create a division of labor, to stipulate wages for workers, and impose a system of rules and laws for their behavior and conduct. The government's control on guild members' behavior arises out of what Athelstan was trying to do, to keep civic peace. Stonemasons were not permitted to work at night or on holidays, and this was for the public good, as stonemasons are very loud, their chisels and their hammers and whatnot. Blacksmiths had to control the exhaust of their furnaces, so the smoke doesn't annoy all their neighbors, etc. This is a part of keeping the peace. Here again, wages were used to ensure this level of civic control amongst the tradesmen. Now, the guilds were structured thusly: apprentices, journeymen, and masters. Of course, we as masons called the journeymen fellow crafts or fellows of the craft. An apprentice was usually a teenager who was under contract to live with and work under a master for a specific number of years, as would be outlined in their contract. Usually the apprentice's parents will pay the master to train their child, but the master could eventually start paying the apprentice for their work if such was in the contract. And many of these contracts survive. This is how Epstein is able to so immensely detail the development of the guilds. The time frame of apprenticeship was dependent on the guild and the rules outlined by the local government. An apprenticeship could last anywhere from 5 to 8 years. An apprentice would probably start off cleaning the master's house and shop, setting out tools for the journeymen who work under the master, doing the cooking, etc. Now, after enough time, the apprentice would eventually go on to do menial work of the trade they are learning, and eventually start to do the real work. It is believed that the production of a masterpiece was necessary to advance to a journeyman, but this proved impractical, and in a vast number of instances in which case a test was conducted, the impracticality comes out of, you got to produce a masterpiece to get out of your contract with the master you work under. And oftentimes that didn't necessarily show competence in your work to produce a masterpiece. So another example would be a case with, say, the wool guilds. What masterpiece could a wooler produce? And even with the stonemason guilds, masterpieces were not heavily enforced, if practiced at all. We don't have many records indicating that from stonemason guilds. But remember, guilds are local, and they differ from town to town based on the regulations and sanctions the government has imposed on them. So even if one guild required a masterpiece, that doesn't mean all the rest do. on to journeymen. Journeymen were just freelancers. They were no longer under contract to apprentice under a master, but they did not own their own business. So they would usually go work for a master's shop. Thus, a master was nothing more than a tradesman who owned his own business and employed journeymen and took on apprentices. Thus, one could lose their title as master if they lost their business. One may notice we still use this system today of apprenticeship and journeymen and masters with plumbers, electricians, tattoo artists, etc. Thus, a guild was a collection of journeymen and masters. Apprentices were under the contractual property of the masters and thus are not usually official members of a guild, though this depended on the guild. Women were permitted to join guilds, but usually in trades that were more women's specific, such as clerical or textile guilds. Some guilds did have oaths of secrecy, but that had less to do with, like, the mysteries of the universe, and more to do with protecting trade secrets, to maintain a monopoly. Yeah, it was more to maintain a monopoly than had anything to do with mystical mysteries and whatnot. Now, the system of the guilds develops greatly over the next couple centuries, and it gets more and more complex as it goes. We see trade systems become more specialized, and thus more specialized guilds are formed. In the 12th century, there would be, say, only the wool guild in a town, but by the 14th century, this had become divided into the wool guild, the wool spinners guild, the wool carters guild, and et al. Like the colleges, guilds had patrons, usually noblemen who had an interest in that guild's trade. So, for instance, if an aristocrat owned, say, a gold mine, it would be in his interest to be a patron of the goldsmith guild, and thus would pay dues to the guild. This was useful for both parties, as the aristocrat could ensure his interests are commercially protected, and the guilds are ensured they have a bureaucrat who can influence and leverage the government on their behalf. Debates ensue as to whether the guild systems stifled innovation and progress in production and commerce throughout the Middle Ages and on into the Renaissance. Certainly, the guild system did ensure that productions were of a certain quality and helped maintain costs for certain work and products, such as prevent overinflation, maintain supplies, etc. They had their merits, but it is possible they prevented the European economy from making much progress due to their rigid control over the trades, hence a monopoly. Ultimately, the guilds would die off in roughly the Enlightenment era. There were two big things that emerged in the 17th century that led to the demise of the guilds. It was two competing economic systems, and remember, the guilds were part of an economic system. Those two competing economic systems that destroyed the guilds were communism and laissez-faire capitalism. Both systems were directly opposed to the guilds for, well, obvious reasons, for being equally opposed to each other. Communism was opposed to the hierarchical structure of the guilds, whereas capitalism was opposed to the guilds, the situation of a monopoly they held. There were, of course, other factors involved. It's European history, it's always much more complex, but those are the two big ones. Dr. Epstein's work does not focus on stonemason guilds to any extent, really, except for a couple of instances. At most, he brings them up to illustrate how the stonemason guilds in particular thought they were special and were exempt from certain laws, and how they thought they were better than everyone else, which kind of, yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, definitely. In the end, the guilds, it was a steady decline. They did not collapse overnight, any more than Rome collapsed overnight. This is obvious by the fact that we still use something like the guild system of apprentice, journeyman, and master today, in certain trades. However, chronologically, we can see that where communism and capitalism began to emerge, we see the guilds decline, and this coincides with the emergence of, well, modern-day Freemasonry. It pops up about the same time. But we are told that speculative masonry emerged from the non-operatives being, quote, accepted into an operative stonemason guild. This would correspond to the guild patron, such as an aristocrat with political connections to favor the guilds as well as his own commercial interests in the business of the guilds themselves. For whatever reason, stonemason guilds began to admit more and more patrons, even those who did not politically benefit them. Perhaps they were hoping for donations or needed more dues money to support themselves. Why the stonemasons, as opposed to, say, the bakers or silversmith guilds, is total mystery. I have no idea why aristocrats were so drawn to the stonemasons guilds. It's open to speculation. One possible theory may be that they saw these guilds as an ancient order that maintained and carried on secrets from long ago, and that's kind of true. The guilds had been around for about 5 centuries. Further, if they did stifle innovation, that means they maintained old traditions. So being traditional could be an insult as well as a compliment here. And seeing as the guilds were on their way out, perhaps these aristocrats saw them as some mystical repository of precious ancient knowledge that was about to be lost, and they craved what they knew and sought to join for good money. But as the number of speculative members grew, they would eventually start to split off and form purely speculative lodges, symbolic lodges. Much in the same way that the wool carders and the wool spinners split off from the wool guild itself. All of this is a lot to take in, but if we were to avoid imposing modern concepts on the past and to view the past based on their time, then it is necessary to understand the guilds in their own context. The guilds are not derived from the Roman collegia, no matter how similar they appear. In fact, we should not desire there to be a genealogical connection between the collegia and the guilds, because the collegia ended under terrible, tyrannical rule and ultimately would transform at their conclusion into revolting factions against the government. When the guilds eventually emerge, they are really just parish confraternities established to maintain civic peace. And when guilds become what we usually think of them as, they emerge spontaneously and simultaneously across Europe. And they do so under a sophisticated economy as a prerequisite. And this is key. Guilds are part of an economic system, namely wage labor economies, further indicative of their economic place in medieval societies. They were monopolies, thus making them secretive and highly protective of their trade secrets, which could only be obtained through an order system of apprenticeship. We certainly see relics of the guild system present in modern-day Freemasonry, but it is not quite how we view them as modern-day Freemasons. Obviously, Masonry grew out of the stonemason guilds, so they wouldn't be identical. But it is interesting to observe the evolution by analyzing the guilds in their own economic context, and then how they grew into modern-day Freemasonry.
What a very interesting and honestly inspiring look at the history of the guilds and the collegium. I have heard so many tales spun by so many different brothers from various lodges, from the seasoned veteran to the brand new master mason who thinks they know everything. This tale of the collegium being somehow represented or somehow attributed to or related to Freemasonry is spouted all the time, and yet they're really, they have more differences than similarities in a multitude of areas. As far as the guilds are concerned, it certainly sounds as if this may be possible. I hope you enjoyed this Masonic Mythbusters segment with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day, who is just an amazing force for scholarship in Freemasonry and in his own right. And I just want to thank Brother Day for his uplifting content, his tireless dedication to Freemasonry, and of course, Masonic education. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining. We will be back again next week. I will be recording an episode very shortly so that you have something to listen to next Sunday on the day I come home, which is also my wife's birthday. So we're going to be a little bit busy that day, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So the next episode you can look forward to, I believe we've got a couple great articles. One that is an excerpt from Brother Joseph Fort Newton, as well as a potential piece from Darren A. Lehners that I was going to read this week, but ran a little bit short on time to be able to record. In any case, I hope you all enjoyed. I hope to see you in Oklahoma, perhaps at Guthrie. I'll be traveling with my good friend and amazing brother, James Buckhorn, who is very excited, has never been to Guthrie, I don't think, before, and we are traveling together. I don't know that we're in the same seats, next to each other or whatever, but we worked it out so we got the same flights. I'm really excited about traveling with James and seeing all my brothers from Oklahoma. It's just going to be a wonderful time. So, again, hope to see you there. One more time, I want to thank the contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast for all of your assistance. If you would like to see how you can help us out, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show to check out your various options there. Everything from subscription-based donations to one-time gifts, all the money goes right back into the production of this podcast and Masonic education. So, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you all next week. And until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
That's it. Okay, you're up.